Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Mirror, mirror, today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A veteran foreign correspondent gets deployed to America. His assignment? Cover the U.S. presidential elections.
Many people have come up to me and they said, you know, please hold a mirror up to ourselves. And almost in a way where people want to see the ugliness of what they see as their present political process reflected to them.
Plus, Arizona may be turning purple, politically I mean, and that's in part because of efforts to register more Latinos. That requires a lot of volunteers knocking on a lot of doors.
Our color is yellow, and so we're like bumblebees. We have been dubbed like bumblebees out there in the neighborhood.
Those stories, plus some American soldiers make it home after 170 years. Today on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being with us. So a little over 5 weeks now until Election Day, and the race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump remains close. Clinton is in the lead, according to most polls, but not by much. So you can expect both campaigns to kick it up several notches in the weeks ahead. As that intensity rises, though, it's important to keep seeking out fresh perspectives on this raucous election season, which is why we're starting today's show with Declan Walsh. He's normally a foreign correspondent for The New York Times, most recently based in Cairo. These days, he's turned his focus to America to report on the U.S. election with an outsider's perspective, much the same way he might do with a news event overseas. Walsh says many people he's talked to overseas can't quite believe what's happening here.
There's a sort of a tone of incredulity that infuses a lot of what I'm receiving. People are watching the way the campaign is being conducted. There's also, I think it's fair to say, a fair degree of concern and worry among people abroad. They're worried about what this election will mean, both for their own countries more directly, but also for the way that politics is conducted. They're seeing this as part of a broader wave of political change across the world, things like the Brexit vote in Britain and so on, that have confounded previous expectations, both about how politics is conducted and also what the results of elections are.
And talk a bit about the mindset of, I know it's hard to generalize, but the mindset of those people overseas. I mean, does that incredulity you're talking about, does it come from people on the left and the right?
It differs from country to country. People are often seeing it reflected through the prism of their own experiences. British people see parallels with Brexit. Italians have written to talk about the parallels with Berlusconi or even with the rise of Mussolini in the 1930s. On the other hand, there have been some people who've certainly, if not expressed support for some of the things that have been said, they've seen parallels of support. I had a very interesting conversation with one analyst in Tunisia who told me that he had detected a large degree of support for Mr. Trump in parts of the Arab world that reflect a sort of a support for strongman politics in their own countries that followed the uncertainties of the Arab Spring. So everybody is seeing it to some degree through their own prism.
What kinds of questions, Declan, have you been getting from America's neighbors to the north and south, Canada and Mexico?
Canadians, I think it's fair to say, are quite worried. I've had a lot of traffic from Canadians who say, we fear for what this election is going to mean for us. People have written in to talk about the danger to trade agreements and so on. In Mexico, it's a very different issue. I've just come from Arizona and Texas, where I was reporting on the border. Over there, Mexicans, or rather the Mexicans who are crossing backwards and forwards over the border, you know, a lot of them, of course, are very hostile towards Mr. Trump, and they're worried for what his election might mean for their ability to move backwards and forwards to the US for those who have passports. But there's also a lot of debate about whether his proposal for a wall would even succeed. I mean, even people down there who support Mr. Trump say that other more sophisticated solutions are needed for that problem.
And Declan, as you've been putting in this time on the road here, taking the pulse of voters, how have you been received?
I've generally been received very well. I've had a lot of feedback from readers inviting me to come and visit various parts of the country. I have, however, detected some hostility towards the media and indeed personally directed towards me in some places. Certainly at some Trump events, there is an attitude of hostility that in part has been whipped up by the candidate himself. I was at an event in Houston a couple of weeks ago, a luncheon that was hosted by a group called the Remembrance Project. The reporters were kept in an area at the back of the hall. And then afterwards, when I tried to interview some members from that group, the organisers became very agitated. They told me that I wasn't welcome, and eventually they asked the hotel management to get me to leave. So that was, to some degree, I felt, depending on which media I think you identify yourself as coming from, the reception can vary accordingly.
Yeah, what does the remembrance group represent?
The remembrance group represents people whose relatives, generally, or friends, but mostly relatives, were killed by illegal Mexican immigrants, or illegal immigrants more generally, but mostly Mexicans, into the United States.
So you've written, Declan, that the biggest mystery for non-Americans when they look at this race is the intense emotions that Secretary Clinton elicits among so many in this country. Do most non-Americans see Clinton as likable?
I think there's a sense of people from abroad that they are confused about why she elicits such strong emotions in the United States, why so many people dislike or even hate her to that degree. People abroad see her as, you know, she's a politician, she's a known factor. They say that, you know, politicians with long careers like Mrs. Clinton's invariably end up in controversies. But they also see, you know, many people have written to say, look, she seems to be someone who seems well qualified for the job, and we don't understand why she's eliciting this kind of emotion.
Do you think that with this global eye on America and this election right now, and the way this election is confusing people around the world, some of them pretty critical of the U.S. right now, could any of this affect the race? I mean, is there a shame factor that could help Clinton, or a we don't care what the rest of the world thinks factor to some of this, and we'll go our own way, thank you very much, that might help Trump?
I don't know what impact it will have on the polls, but certainly a very strong sense I've had from a lot of people I've spoken to, Americans, is that the tenor of this election, the way it's been conducted, the sort of things that are the focus of debate. I mean, just look at this week where a large part of the conversation is about whether Donald Trump insulted a beauty queen 20 years ago about her weight. They see these things as being below the standard of American politics, of a presidential race, of what the office of the presidency should stand for. And a lot of people I see, you know, there's a sense of acute embarrassment. Many people have come up to me and they said, you know, please hold a mirror up to ourselves, and almost in a way where people want to see the ugliness of what they see as their present political process reflected to them.
The New York Times, Declan Walsh, thanks very much for your outsider eyes today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
We're used to hearing a lot about Cuba every presidential election year, you know, because of the important Cuban vote down in Florida. This year is no different, although something is a little different about Cuban migration to the U.S. Ever since the Cuban Revolution began in the 1950s, there's been a strong exile community in Miami, and Cubans have continued to migrate since then, often by sea, taking advantage of a U.S. policy that allows them to stay if they set foot on American soil. Recently, the number of Cubans coming to the U.S. has surged, and more of them are coming by land now, leaving the island for countries like Ecuador in South America, and then making their way north. Erica Barris has a story of one young Cuban who made that trip recently.
When Heidi Vera arrived in Miami, she thought she was done traveling. She had been on the road for a long time, from Ecuador all the way on up.
I saw things you don't see in Cuba. Gangs, you may be killed, people may shoot guns. But I was ready for anything, because I knew I wasn't in my country anymore.
She crossed borders, walked many miles, took planes, buses, trains. Several times she was detained, once hospitalized. She slept on streets and in laundromats. Along the way, she met other Cubans making the journey. They stuck together. She was robbed, forced to pay bribes, and all the while fiercely guarded her Cuban citizenship paperwork, which helped promise her residency in the United States.
It was a difficult trip for us because other Latinos from Costa Rica and Nicaragua, Honduras, they'd say, if I'm also a Latino, why don't they give us the opportunity to come to this country? But you, yes. And we were afraid, the other Latinos, that they would assault us, that they'd steal our passports, our papers, because with those papers, you can come in.
Back in Pinal del Río on the western side of Cuba, Heidi's mother makes the equivalent of $8 a month at a pig butchery. Heidi had studied to do administrative work and wanted more from life. By the time she arrived in Miami, the 24-year-old was broke and forced to stay in shelters with some of the people she'd met on her trip. But she got lucky. A local activist posted on Facebook that newly arrived Cubans needed help. Gregoria Fernandez, a 50-year-old woman in Pittsburgh, saw the post and commented on it.
So I offered. I said, look, my house isn't big, but I live in Pittsburgh. If they're willing to come here, there's work. There's opportunity for everyone.
Gregoria and her partner live in a two-bedroom apartment. She shows me the black mold in the bathroom and the sagging ceilings. But it's home. And she remembered how hard it was when she herself came here from Cuba.
First of all, it's the language. You know that without language, it's like throwing yourself in a river and not knowing how to swim.
She left Cuba during the mid-90s. At that time, Cubans were going by raft to U.S. soil at Guantanamo and from there on to South Florida. That's where she settled. And then during the financial crisis, moved up to Pittsburgh looking for work. Her life was pretty quiet until the Cubans showed up. They show me around, laughing about how Gregoria crammed everyone in. They slept all over the house. It was pretty makeshift, but Heidi says she felt so at home.
When we got here, she had everything. It's like we say, you're at your family's house now. We didn't have to do anything. Here we got food, clothes.
Today, Heidi and Gregoria are both back from early morning shifts at their jobs. They move around the kitchen, sweeping, cooking, talking over each other. For Gregoria, it wasn't totally altruistic. She was alone all the time because she and her partner work opposite hours. He at a Chinese restaurant, she stocking shelves at Macy's.
So I was also looking for company. So I said, why don't I have these people come here? That way they can keep me company and I can keep them company, because I was really lonely.
While the group of nine Cubans were there, it was fun for her, hearing stories of what life is like back home, helping them figure out the U.S. for the first time, cooking big meals, which she hadn't had a chance to do since her own kids were already grown.
It's not like I can help like 20 people. You help as many as you can. I took a bunch of them to immigration to do their paperwork to be allowed to work. I was an interpreter as much as I could be, but my English isn't like, wow, amazing.
But then slowly they started leaving. All these months later, the Christmas stockings are still hanging on the living room wall, the glitter from their names slowly crumbling onto the floor. Now it's just Heidi, who recently applied for her green card. She sends money home to Cuba she earns at an Italian restaurant. Gregoria says she'd host more but hasn't seen any posts looking for help. And because her landlord said he'd raise the rent if more people live there, she can't host too many more people. Still, if they showed up, she says she'll help them out. In the meantime, though, Gregoria likes having Heidi around. Heidi calls Gregoria tía, aunt, and plans on staying there indefinitely. They keep each other company and connect each other to a homeland they both miss. For The World, Erica Barris, Pittsburgh.
Before the break, a quick look at something we'll have tomorrow on the show. Zara Nur Baksh is a comedian and podcaster who came out as bisexual on her podcast, #GoodMuslimBadMuslim. She says that at first it was a relief.
And then, of course, then I was terrified. I was terrified of the politics of it, of whether it was appropriate, whether I could speak on the matter. And then also, of course, my parents listened to the podcast and I was like, what are they going to think? And do I tell them? And in the beginning, I sort of was like, yeah, fine, I'll tell them. It's no big deal, whatever. Then I just started to feel really, really sick. And like bugs were crawling all up and down my body and really scared. And I was really afraid of all of their reactions.
Her story tomorrow here on The World. And coming up in a few, securing the Ryder Cup and tickets to it here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Arizona is definitely a key state to watch this presidential election cycle. It's a border state where a few years ago lawmakers approved one of the nation's toughest anti-immigration laws. Traditionally, Arizona has also been a red state, voting Republican in most recent presidential contests. But that might be shifting this year. The conservative Arizona Republic newspaper this week endorsed Hillary Clinton for president, the first time it's endorsed a Democrat over a Republican in its entire 126-year history. And here's another big change. Latinos in Arizona are increasingly making their voices heard. Petra Falcón directs a group called Promise Arizona. And Petra, your organization is part of the One Arizona Coalition that's trying to present a response to the tough anti-immigrant climate in Arizona. What are you currently doing to galvanize the Latino vote?
Well, Promise Arizona began in 2010 in the middle of what we called a firestorm, our Arizona legislature passing the notorious SB 1070 law that was dubbed Show Me Your Papers law. And what this legislation gave license to was our law enforcement community to, because of suspicion of someone perhaps being undocumented, to ask them for their papers if they were jaywalking, if they had a broken taillight, they were walking across the park. It just gave license to law enforcement officers asking people for their papers. And immediately we feel demonized the most vulnerable members of our community, which are immigrants. And so it was just a real slap in the face to people who come here to work really, really hard.
And did SB 1070 also kind of fuel your activism?
Absolutely. And what we've been doing, we have been registering many, many people to vote. In fact, I think our latest count is just Promise Arizona, over 46,000 new voters across the state.
Wow, that's impressive. So how do you go about this? Just the classic way, knocking on doors?
The hard work of voter registration, yes, means that you go door to door. You go to institutions like churches, high schools, community colleges, universities, the neighborhood barbershop, nail place, you go to grocery stores, you go to community events, you go to the parks, you just are out there. You know, we're like bumblebees out there in the neighborhoods trying to get as many voter registrations as possible. And right now in Arizona, we're trying to register as many people through October 10th. That's the deadline to be able to vote in this year's presidential election.
At this point in the campaign, what are the things that are spurring voter registration?
SB 1070 was the tipping point. It was also the increased number of deportations. Our fight to win comprehensive immigration reform that's continually been stalled at the national level. So all of that is fueling the energy on the ground because we know what's at stake as to who is in the White House. So there is a lot at stake for Arizona.
The Arizona Republic newspaper, of course, has endorsed a Democrat for president for the first time in 126 years. What's your reaction to that?
In Arizona, and of course, Arizona Republic is part of that community, we've lived what divisive, racist language is being used this year in the presidential cycle, and that Arizona can't live through another decade, perhaps. We've got to bring the community back together. SB 1070 really hurt our state's economy. It really hurt families. And I believe that that is one of the reasons the Arizona Republic decided to do that. And probably because it's about choosing a candidate that is prepared to be president. I think for the person that perhaps has not made up their mind, and cares about Arizona and respects, you know, this statewide newspaper, I think it will make a difference because we've lived through the hateful environment that the divisive language has done to our community and our state.
Petra Falcón directs Promise Arizona. Petra, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the issue of Arizona's changing demographic is something I'm going to be looking at next week. We're taking the show on the road and broadcasting from KJZZ in Phoenix on Monday. Tune in for more on the Latino vote next week. All you golf fans out there already know this. Tomorrow, the Ryder Cup officially gets underway. The tournament is a big deal. A team of top U.S. golfers like Phil Mickelson and Jordan Spieth against their European counterparts like Rory McIlroy. It's America's turn to host this year, but the chosen course might surprise you. It's not in Florida or Georgia or California. It's in Minnesota. And the world's Jonathan Keeling is pretty stoked to have scored some tickets.
Certainly, golf is not what you think of first when you think of Minnesota. However, there's a great golf course just suburban Minneapolis, Hazeltine National. It's hosted PGA Championships. It's hosted a lot of golf's majors. And they made a play to host the Ryder Cup and got it. And it's actually a pretty unusual thing because the Ryder Cup is only played every other year. And it rotates between the U.S. and Europe. So it's only in the United States every 4 years. So for courses to get to have the Ryder Cup requires a lot of, you know, advertising, a lot of promotion, and a lot of convincing people that it's the right place. And Hazeltine really is a really nice golf course.
So how hard was it to get tickets for you and your dad to see this?
This was a pretty big deal.
Lottery kind of thing?
It's definitely a lottery. About 18 months ago, I discovered that the Ryder Cup was coming to Minneapolis, and my dad and I set out a plan that we were each going to enter the lottery, maybe enlist my brother, my uncle, so we can get as many entries as we could, and we ended up getting one of the entries that we put in the lottery won. It was actually my dad's. So almost a year ago, we bought tickets, and he received them in the mail several months ago. This morning, he actually texted me in a panic because it turned out he'd thrown the tickets away.
Oh, no.
But we were able to call the Ryder Cup folks, and they reprinted them, and we'll pick them up at Will Call Friday morning.
Whew. Yeah, big one there.
Yeah.
So this is a large tournament, a lot of spectators, and it's outdoors. What have you heard from officials in the Twin Cities about preparations for the crowd?
You know, they're doing a lot. It's actually in a particular suburb called Chaska, and they passed a whole special series of local laws pertaining just to the Ryder Cup. They've established this massive perimeter that extends several blocks beyond the golf course where no pedestrians or vehicles are allowed at all. In fact, the perimeter actually includes several neighborhoods, and residents of those neighborhoods are only allowed out of their house if they're in a vehicle that's been issued a special credential that shows they live in the neighborhood. So if you want to walk your dog, you better get in the car and take him to the dog park, because if they see you out, they're going to stop you. And they say the reason for this is terrorism. Originally, the Ryder Cup was held in odd-numbered years, but the event scheduled for 2001 was actually postponed out of concerns that the players would become targets. So it now plays in even numbered years.
Yeah. So is there any specific threat that they're thinking about, or they're just being prepared?
You know, I haven't heard anyone talking about specific threats against the Ryder Cup, but there was so much talk about terrorism in the Olympics, terrorism in the World Cup. I think it's just something that goes with major global sporting events in this day and age.
Yeah, just the time we live in. So the tee off is on Friday. You'll be there bright and early?
Yeah, my dad and I have made plans to catch a ride out to one of the shuttle pickup spots, ride a bus in, and be there in time for 7:30 first tee off. So it's going to be early.
The World's Jonathan Keeling. Will you be tweeting there?
Oh, yeah.
Great. We'll look forward to it. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much, Marco.
News headlines are coming right up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Adele Welty's son was a New York firefighter. He died in the 9/11 attacks. Now she could be part of a lawsuit against Saudi Arabia over its alleged role in the attacks.
We don't really know the whole story, and maybe if it goes to court, we'll find out.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It was a pretty decisive defeat for President Obama. Both houses of Congress voted by pretty wide margins to override his veto of a controversial bill. First veto override, in fact, for Obama. The bill allows the families of 9/11 victims to sue the government of Saudi Arabia for allegedly supporting the attackers. The Saudis have always denied that, and the White House argues this legislation could have serious repercussions for the U.S. around the globe. We'll hear about that from an international law expert in a few minutes. First, though, we turn to Adele Welty. She lost her son, firefighter Timothy Welty, in the attacks on the World Trade Center. Ms. Welty, thanks very much for taking the time today to talk with us. When you heard that the Senate had overridden President Obama's veto, what crossed your mind?
Well, the first thing that crossed my mind was a purported quote from the former First Lady of Vietnam when she said, "The chickens are coming home to roost." And I wondered if the chickens will be coming home to roost when this lawsuit takes place, because I'm aware that the United States and the CIA have interfered in the internal affairs of so many sovereign countries. And I'm wondering if Saudi Arabia is no longer accorded sovereign immunity, if the United States then will no longer have sovereign immunity, and there'll be a rush of lawsuits against us for
our interference in the affairs of other countries.
Hmm. I mean, in other words, you're worried that other countries would want to sue the U.S. government or U.S. officials. What do you say, though, to families who see this as their time to seek justice? How would you talk to them about this?
I understand that, and I certainly think we should seek justice. And hopefully, if it goes to court now, the truth will emerge. Whether or not it's justice remains to be seen.
Are you in touch? Do you communicate with any victims' families who are planning to sue?
I'm involved in one of those lawsuits, mostly because I thought it would reveal information about who, if anybody, really was involved. And maybe it's a good thing that if this goes to court, we'll find out.
And when you say you're involved in a lawsuit, does that mean you're an actual plaintiff?
Yes.
So, in fact, you are part of a group of people suing the Saudis presently, is that right?
Yes. So, as I say, I'm very ambivalent. I'm really not sure what the right thing is to do.
You know, given little what we know about any connections between the hijackers and the Saudi government, how would your son Timothy have felt about suing the Saudis? Would he see this as some kind of justice?
I don't know. I don't know what he would have thought. We never talked politics. He was a libertarian, I know that. But I found that out after the fact, not very long ago, as a matter of fact.
Hmm.
I really have no idea how he would have felt. If he had survived, he would have lost so many friends, 19 just from his firehouse.
Wow. I know that since 9/11, Adele, you've been active with the group September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Would you say that makes you an activist?
Well, I was a lot more of an activist in my younger days. I'm 80 now, and I would say retired.
Are you worried that families suing the Saudis may not actually lead to more peaceful tomorrows?
Once the lawsuit goes forward, it will be covered in the press and the media. I'm fearful of an increase in Islamophobia. Thousands, really, of peaceful families who happen to be Muslims are living in fear. Children are being harassed at school. There is a tendency towards very strong racist beliefs and actions lately, not only in the United States, but in Europe as well. That's very, very frightening. And these are all things that I think come into play that maybe we haven't thought about too carefully.
Adele Welty, the mother of firefighter Timothy Welty, who died when his company, Squad 288 in Queens, responded to the World Trade Center attacks on 9/11. Thank you very much talking this through. Really appreciate it, Adele.
You're welcome.
The White House was stung pretty badly by yesterday's veto override. Press Secretary Josh Earnest called the Senate's 97-1 vote on the bill the single most embarrassing thing that the United States Senate has done, possibly, since 1983. That was the year the Senate voted 95-0 to override a veto by President Reagan. But let's get back to why President Obama objected to this bill so much. We just heard Ms. Welty refer to some of the same reasons. To paraphrase the president's position here, he believes that allowing the families of 9/11 victims to sue Saudi Arabia opens up a legal can of worms for the U.S. internationally. To learn more about that, I spoke with Philippe Sands. He's an international law expert at University College London.
There's a long-established principle of international law that states are absolutely immune from the jurisdiction of national courts unless they have agreed in advance on exceptions. And that rule serves to allow states to engage in all sorts of activities as between themselves. One of the exceptions that was agreed many decades ago was for commercial activity. So states don't have absolute immunity for commercial activity. But there is no agreement on a loss of immunity, for example, for allegations of involvement in terrorism or other international crimes. And I think once one state decides to accord itself the right to strip other states of immunity in relation to that area, you've got a recipe for disaster.
How real is that possibility that if American families start suing the Saudi government, that other governments would see a window of opportunity and start suing the U.S. government?
Well, just to take an example, I mean, you've got the events after September the 11th, when the United States turned to, harsh interrogation techniques, as some people put it, torture, others call it. There's never been accountability. Some people will say, well, okay, if the U.S. is opening the door to cases against Saudi Arabia, why can't we open the door to cases against the United States for that kind of behavior? And you can see that essentially it's endless. I mean, the rationale behind a rule on immunity for states and for those in government service right now is precisely to ensure that there's no sort of freezing of diplomacy, no freezing of political relationships, to stop a sort of wealth of lawsuits across the world in relation to issues where people feel aggrieved. And a lot of people feel very aggrieved around the world about a lot of different things.
Yeah, one of the consequences you mentioned of this congressional veto of the veto is a lot of lawsuits flying all over the world. Let me put this to you. Is there an advantage to having much fuller transparency, opening up the records of all these governments? Is that such a bad thing?
Well, if you go back nearly 20 years and you remember the arrest of Senator Pinochet in London, he was a former head of state of Chile, and he was arrested and charged with international crimes. I went on the BBC back then saying that for a former head of state, there should be no immunity for jurisdiction for these courts. And I think on policy grounds, that is right. The difficulty with this legislation is that it exposes states, not just former heads of state, and serving government officials to the possibility of lawsuits. And I do think that is potentially very problematic because, precisely because, there are so many areas around the world in which there are aggrieved individuals who would like nothing better than to take foreign states before their national courts. And so states around the world have sort of said, we're not going to allow that to happen. And you can understand the rationale. It's a sort of self-serving, self-interested type of behavior, but it does have a rational basis. And I think that when the United States, if and when the United States starts get suing around the world and is met with the response to the claim for immunity that you've done this in the States, why should you have immunity now and we didn't have it over there? That's a difficult question to answer.
Yeah, so, Philippe, where do you, as an international lawyer, fall on all this? Obama's right or Congress is right?
I'm pretty sympathetic to President. I'm pretty sympathetic to both sides. But ultimately, I think President Obama is right. If you're going to move away from absolute immunity from these kinds of situations, you've got to do it on the basis of agreements, I think, between states. And you've got to circumscribe, as states did many years ago in relation, for example, to commercial activity. It used to be that there was absolute immunity, and it meant that commercial transactions also claimed immunity. That door was opened up about 30 years ago. And if there's going to be an exception for terrorism or international crimes, I think it's got to be on the basis of a sort of collaborative, cooperative effort by governments around the world. One state doing this, I think, is potentially a recipe for disaster.
Philippe Sands is an international law expert. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Lovely to be with you.
For our next story, I have the world's Nina Porzucchi in the studio with me.
Hello, Marco.
So you co-host our podcast about language, the world in words. Tell us what's on the podcast this week.
Well, I don't know. Have you checked out the new Chelsea Handler talk show on Netflix?
I used to watch her on the E! Exclamation Point Network, but I haven't seen the new one.
Well, she has a new show. It started in this past May, and Netflix is calling it the world's, quote, first global talk show. And by global, they mean that three times a week when a new episode is released on Netflix, it's also released simultaneously in 20 different languages.
Okay, that's why it's global, because I was going to ask you, Chelsea Handler global. But
yeah,
20 different languages, how do they do that?
20 different languages. So I was curious about that, too. How do they figure out how to translate, you know, this 30-minute non-scripted talk show comedy, you know, translation, comedy doesn't translate, blah, 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 in under 24 hours in 20 languages. But that actually got me thinking to something separate about really how sound changed everything in film. There's quotes from directors like Charlie Chaplin and D.W. Griffith, who believed at one point that silent film, before sound came into the picture, could be the answer to global communication. It could be the universal Esperanto. So here's Chaplin in a 1954 interview with the BBC and a bit of an excerpt from the podcast.
You see, I think art form is only really a great form by virtue of its limitations. It's like paintings in two dimensions. And it's the same thing in the silent films, you see. The moment we put language to them, they heard the, and it was vocal and audible. And we heard, we had some very bad experiences, or very dull ones at least.
Film, that is silent film, was supposed to unite our post-Babel world, to elevate us all. And then sound came in and complicated everything.
Yeah, I was just about to say the Tower of Babel had been, you know, crumbled or defeated or whatnot, that curse.
Bruce Lawton is a film historian, archivist, and all-out silent film geek. Before sound, he says, silent films were easily sent around the globe.
Once you've got the studios going, if you made some big production, you would send it to other countries by virtue of agreements that had been set up, and then all you really had to do was switch out the titles. For the most part, if you created a production, you could send it to other countries and not worry about the language barrier.
So it was fairly universal.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Griffith once said when the specter of sound was on the horizon, he said, why would I want to lose 95% of my audience? You know, he was also a businessman. He was concerned about the finances of it. He's like, you know, my films go all over the world.
Studios tried to figure out a way to make talkies as global as their predecessors.
One of the things that a number of the studios started to do or experimented with were they started to say, okay, here's the script. We're making, you know, this picture. And they would shoot it a number of times in different languages. Whoever the lead actor or actors were would have to recite these different languages phonetically using cue cards off camera. And then they would often cast the rest of the picture with actual actors who those languages were their native language.
That sounds and like so, laborious. Like, that sounds like it would be awful.
There's actually some surviving Laurel and Hardy early sound films where there are these alternate versions in different languages, and it's hysterical.
¿Estás seguro que tu mamá y tu papá se llamaban Laurel?
Seguro que sí. ¿Por qué?
Hardy does a pretty good job, he's of at least the feeling of the different romance languages, and Stan just murders them. And I think audiences, because they're a comic duo, it was probably a plus to hear these beloved comedians that they'd gotten to know in the silent era now speaking, hearing them speaking in their own language, but you know, maybe messing it up must have been an added bonus.
¿Dónde está?
En la Universidad de Barcelona.
Ah, vamos bien. ¿Qué es? Professor?
No, está en un frasco.
That was the first idea to how to keep those markets open.
Oh, I don't know what's funnier, their stilted delivery or their accents.
That is really interesting. So Charlie Chaplin, if he thought the silent movies were kind of the universal Esperanto, he must have had mixed feelings about the talkies, even though he seemed to adapt pretty well. I mean, just look at The Great Dictator.
Yeah, and actually, I go into that in the podcast a little bit. He was known as the Great Holdout, and he actually made the last Hollywood studio silent picture, Modern Times. It has a synchronized soundtrack, so there is some kind of ambient sound, and he does sing at the end.
That's Modern Times.
That's Modern Times.
Great movie.
Great movie. And then, you know, you'll have to listen to the podcast, but we actually talk about when he does make his first talkie, which is The Great Dictator. He does a couple interesting things with language in that film.
So you do have to listen to the rest of the story on this week's podcast. You can get The World in Words on iTunes or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. Nina Porzucchi, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
For several years now, researchers at Middle Tennessee State University have been trying to crack a forensics case that goes back to 1846. That's the year when the Mexican-American War started and when one of the conflict's bloodiest battles was fought in Monterrey in northern Mexico. Seems hard to believe, but thanks in part to the efforts of those researchers in Tennessee, the remains of several U.S. soldiers killed in that battle 170 years ago were returned to the U.S. yesterday. They were received with full military honors at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, just like those from much more recent conflicts. The World's History guy Chris Wolf is on the story. So who were these men, Chris?
We're talking about the remains of 11 to 13 men. They can't be exactly sure just yet. And they're from an area of the battlefield where we know that troops from Tennessee and Mississippi were fighting along with U.S. regular troops. Now some 35 Tennessee men fell in the battle, and that's why the Tennesseans have gotten interested now. Tennessee's nickname is the Volunteer State, and they sent a lot of guys down to join the Mexican War.
So give us a little historical background here. Why were they fighting in Monterrey?
Well, you know, the U.S. has been involved in some wars of pretty questionable character, but it was part of manifest destiny that American politicians at the time thought they were entitled to define and secure the southern border pretty much anywhere they liked, and that meant going to war with Mexico.
What was this battle like?
Well, you got to imagine, just a few weeks before, these Tennesseans were on their farms and workshops in central Tennessee when the call came out from the War Department for volunteers. And within a few weeks, they've come down by steamer to Louisiana, across the sea to Brownsville, Texas. And within a few weeks, they're in battle. You imagine Monterrey is a city on a hill, heavily fortified. You know, you've probably had all kinds of stomach upsets. You've had a long, tough march across some pretty arid zones, up through the Hip Mountains, and now you're looking up this fortification on top of this dusty hill, and you know, you've got a tough fight ahead of you. So they pushed up there and ultimately won in a very long 3-day battle.
And those who didn't make it out, I mean, what do we know about them, these 11 or 13 men? Do they have names?
Well, the names of most of the fallen are known from documentary evidence, but the chances of matching them with the bodies that have been found is very remote, to quote the lead scientist on the project. But you can compare it with what documents we have. I mean, some units recorded descriptions, so you can tell height, eye color, hair color, and some of that can be extrapolated from DNA.
So what happens now, and will they get a burial at Arlington?
Well, ultimately, they will be reinterred with full military honors. Tennessee politicians are arguing that they should be interred at a cemetery that's dedicated to the victims of the Mexican-American War that's in Tennessee. So we'll have to see what happens. But right now, what's going to be happening is the scientists will be taking the opportunity to extract every piece of information they can about what life was like for soldiers and volunteers in the Mexican-American War. Even though they're not confident that they'll be able to identify individuals, they can pull out all kinds of strands of evidence about the overall health of the soldier, what their life was like. I mean, in other remains, in other wars, they've found that soldiers have spinal compaction injuries because they've been carrying heavy loads for so long. The types of wounds they suffer, the treatments they got for those wounds, and, you know, all kinds of other interesting things that can tell you about, you know, a little glimpse of life back in the 1840s.
It is a fascinating but surreal echo of the modern wars we've lived through, Chris. The World's Chris Wolf, our history guy, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
This Sunday, more than 50 years of war could come to an end in Colombia. Voters there will decide whether to approve the peace agreement signed this week by the Colombian government and the FARC rebel group. Reporter Beto Arcos was just in Colombia attending an annual music industry festival known as the Bogota Music Market, and he talked with young musicians there about the prospects for peace.
The Bogota Music Market opened with a roar of sound from the electropical hip-hop band Sistema Solar. The annual gathering was held during an emotional period for Colombia. The peace agreement and the vote coming up on October 2nd were on everyone's mind.
This is a very tense time, a tense social time. People going towards the yes, people going towards the no.
Daniel Restrepo is in the yes camp. He leads a jazz band called Fatso.
I'm more towards the, if there's any possibility of no one getting killed anymore, then I go towards the yes. I'm not sure if it's going to work. I have my doubts sometimes. I think it's been a long war, so there's a whole bunch of people who have been in it since they're kids. So it's very difficult. But I think if there's any chance of starting that peace process, it's very important. This time is awesome. I hope everything goes well.
Singer Maria Mulata is on the yes side, too. When she was 6 years old, she wrote her first song, Quiero Paz, I Want Peace.
Quiero, quiero que en el mundo haya paz.
Y era una canción como tan infantil, decía, quiero, quiero que en el mundo haya paz. Tú y yo vamos a jugar, pero no al mal.
She says it was a children's song with the words, I want peace in the world, you and I, let's play. But let's not play evil. It was one of the songs on her first album that she recorded with her brother. And it's because they've never known peace, she says. A
At a concert called Biche por la Paz, A Drink for Peace, hundreds of young people danced to the music of Canalón de Timbiquí, a traditional Afro-Colombian ensemble from the Pacific Coast. Singer Nidia Góngora says her region has suffered a great deal during the war, but a peace agreement is only the start of what needs to happen there.
Colombia is a país donde hay mucha desigualdad. Y yo te aseguro que mientras haya hambre.
Colombia is a country with a vast inequality, she says, and as long as there's hunger and a lack of education and healthcare for the poor, the real conflict will not end. Stuart Bailey knows something about what it's like after a peace agreement takes effect. He's a co-founder of the OYEA Music Center in Belfast, and he was in Bogota giving a talk about music during and after the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Bailey says music was essential for young people like him during the 70s and 80s, when things were at their worst.
You know, we had a very lively punk scene, which was very rebellious, and it kind of more or less told people to ignore the two traditions and find your own alternative Ulster, to use a phrase from the band Stiff Little Fingers. So music kind of liberated my generation, it liberated our minds.
Bailey says in Colombia now, he can feel a cautious optimism. No one is throwing a hat in the air just yet, he says, but people sense that things can and will change for the better.
I met probably 20, 30 individuals who are all working in their own way for the future of Colombia through music, and that was very exciting. That was very good for my heart. I can't pretend to understand the absolute context of everything that goes on in here, but I just know, you know, my phrase is that music never lets you down. Music is always there, and it is an incredible catalytic force.
For the world, Beto Arcos, Bogota, Colombia.
He perseguido señales, abandonado tristezas, he respondido preguntas a las que nunca hay respuesta.
Music by Maria Mulata puts the wraps on our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.